Good morning. Thank you for coming out on this cold, blustery March morning. We're delighted you could be with us here today. On behalf of the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Jennings Randolph Program for International Peace, I'd like to welcome you here today. I'm Ginny Bouvier. I'm a program officer in the JR program. And we're pleased to have you here for a discussion on business's role in peacemaking and to celebrate the publication of Jill Shankelman's new book on this topic, Oil, Profits, and Peace, Does Business Have a Role in Peacemaking, hot off the press here at USIP. I'd also like to say a word of welcome to the author. As the project officer, when Jill was developing the manuscript that we see in print today, I had the occasion to read it not one but many times, and it is a special thrill to see it in print, and I want to congratulate Jill for her hard work getting it to today's version. The theme of conflict and oil is hardly a new one to USIP, as you'll see from a variety of publications that are available outside, and I should say also Jill's book is available for sale as you come in. But to my knowledge, this is the first full-length book study on the topic supported by USIP. We've asked Chairman West to open and moderate today's session, to be followed by a presentation by Jill of some of the highlights of her study. We've also invited Orin Wychie Shaw on the far end, Nick Welch here in the middle, and Kenneth Bacon as representatives of the U.S. government, the oil industry, and the NGO community, respectively, to serve as discussants. We also recognize that there is tremendous expertise here in this room, and we are committed to leaving a nice long period where we can have a discussion and question and answer. We've prepared extensive bios of each of the panelists, which you should have. So I'll just say a few words to highlight about each of them before I turn over the podium to Chairman West. Jill Shankelman, author of this book, was a senior fellow at USIP in 2003 and 2004. And is now a senior advisor for the World Bank's political risk insurance arm, MIGA, the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency, where she's setting up a new fund working with MIGA's private sector clients in Africa on social and environmental management. She is speaking here today, however, in her own capacity and not as a representative of the bank. Orin Wychie Shaw is senior advisor in the Office of African Nations at the U.S. Treasury. Prior to joining Treasury, she was TechnoServe's Regional Director for Africa, Division Manager of Investment Operations at the African Development Bank, Private Sector Advisor for USAID, Acoustics Business Manager at Owens Corning, and Vice President of International Corporate Finance at Citibank. Nick Welch, just to Jill's left, is currently Manager for International Relations for Shell Oil Company and has been based in, and is based in Washington, D.C. He served previously as the head of the UK External Relations and Government Relations Manager for Shell, Shell International in London, and he was private secretary to the UK Secretary of State for Trade and Industry and the Minister of Energy. Ken Bacon, on the far left of the panel, or your far right, I guess, is currently the president of Refugees International and co-chairman of the Partnership for Effective Peace Operations. He previously served as Assistant Secretary of Public Affairs at the U.S. Department of Defense and was a reporter, editor, and columnist for the Wall Street Journal. And finally, our moderator today is J. Robinson West, Robin, Chairman of the Board and founder of PFC Energy and the current Chairman of the Board of the U.S. Institute of Peace. Chairman West has held a variety of positions in the U.S. government, including as Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Policy, Budget, and Administration, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Economic Affairs, and has served on the White House staff. As I turn the podium over to our chair, I would ask, if you haven't already done so, that you please turn off any cell phones or electronic devices. They will interfere with our sound system if you do not. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My introduction will be brief, and hopefully we will moderate, have a chance to moderate an animated panel. I just want to open by saying I think the question of oil and money, and I'm in the oil business, that the question of oil and money and politics and governance is a really big issue. That very few, it's one of those really big, really complicated, really tedious issues that people don't want to spend a lot of time on. But it's something that is going to be of tremendous, of profound importance in terms of the governance of a lot of the world, and also of I think the stability of the oil markets. So this goes into, this is high economics, high energy, and high politics. Jill's book, I think, is an important book. It's an excellent piece of scholarship. It's also very thought-provoking. And as I say, I just think that this is a very important subject. It's one close to my heart in both my PFC energy capacity and also as chairman of the Institute of Peace. That is my very brief introduction. We have a gathering of eagles today, and rather than listen to me, I want to turn it over to Jill to lay things out, and then we will go through Oren, Nick, and Ken, representing different points of view, who I think are quite expert on the subject, and then I hope we will have an animated dialogue amongst ourselves here and amongst you there. But thank you for coming, and Jill, I turn it over to you.
Thank you, Robin. Okay, it's great to see you all here today. Some friends, some people I haven't yet met. I'm going to start with just a few words about my background and where I've come from in writing this book. So I've been working in the private sector for most of my career as a consultant, working with businesses and governments, first on environmental policy and legislation, and really for the last 10 years on the social impacts of private sector activity, particularly on large-scale investments in oil fields, infrastructure, chemical plants, looking at how these projects affect people in the neighbourhood around and the society more widely, and what companies can do to understand those impacts and to mitigate the risks that adverse impacts pose to their investments as well as to the wider society. And most of my work has been on Western businesses investing in developing countries. I'm not an academic, and I came to the task of writing this book really in a consultancy frame of mind. What are the problems? What are the potential solutions? What can we learn from the work that scholars have done? And I've relied very heavily on some of the excellent work of economists and political scientists. And what can we learn from the experience of people and organizations that have faced these issues? So the book consolidates really a lot of what I've learned as a consultant, plus the ability during my time at USIP to be a bit more systematic in my thinking. So in this book, I really look at how the international oil industry works, particularly the production end. I look at the implications of oil production for producing countries, and especially the links with conflict and peace, and then at the potential for oil companies to contribute to peacemaking. And I'm using peacemaking in the widest possible sense, and you'll see it's primarily conflict prevention that I'm thinking about. And there are four particular experiences that really led to the way this has worked out. First of all, in the late 1990s, I was interviewing senior officials from the Angolan Health and Education Ministries in the context of a social impact assessment I was doing for one of the oil companies. What I found is that these officials knew that the health and education provision in their country was appalling. It just was almost non-existent. And they knew they had plans for how it could be made better. But what they didn't have, and remember these were members of the small Angolan elite, they had absolutely no idea of when Angola was going to get more money from its oil production, and no idea of how much money Angola was likely to receive. This information was really held only at the highest levels of the MPLA and the presidency. So these people were effectively disempowered from working the political system to secure resources for development. Next, over 2001-2, I was working in Azerbaijan on the early stages of planning two huge international pipelines, so 1,700 kilometres of steel carrying oil and gas from the Caspian Sea out to Western markets. And my job involved talking to lots of people in Azerbaijan and internationally to start understanding the potential impacts of these pipelines. And two things I heard surprised and worried me. First, there was a small but persistent argument made by some of the NGOs that the oil companies developing these pipelines had both the responsibility and the power to put pressure on the government to resolve the Nagorno-Karabakh dispute, war, frozen conflict. But I also, the other thing is that I also consistently heard from individuals at all level of Azeri society that the real benefit for their country from the new oil fields being developed is that it would give them the resources to win the war. This was very widespread. Third, when I arrived in DC to start the fellowship in autumn 2003, there was a widely articulated view in this town that Iraq's oil wealth would contribute powerfully and positively to the goal of creating a stable democratic market economy in Iraq. And this ran counter to the findings of a lot of work on the curse of oil and the real problems that oil wealth posed for stability. And then the other trigger is that I wanted to report on what I see as a very significant change that's happened in parts of the oil industry over the last 10 years or so in terms of corporate social responsibility. And there's some really good work being done by some in the industry. For example, their activity in or their involvement in launching important initiatives like EITI and the Voluntary Principles on Security and Human Rights, and really profound efforts to change the way in which they operate locally. So what do I do in the book? I try to explain the basic political economy of oil and then present a simple model for understanding the conflict risks and what companies can do. Key points about the oil economy. The starting point of understanding oil production and conflict risks is the profit in oil, the difference between the cost of producing a barrel of oil and the market price. When, as over the last few years, global demand rises faster than global production, this profit is huge. Cost data is really difficult to find, but quite a generous estimate might be costs, production costs of $10 a barrel and a market price of $50 to $60. The second key point is that in most cases, it's governments who own these resources, and governments are the main beneficiaries of these projects, of these profits. Typically, they receive at least 45% and as much as 90% of the profits of oil production. So the hidden story of oil is that governments are the big winners. And I quote a journalist's estimate that in 2006, the government of Nigeria was in receipt of $2 million an hour in oil revenues from its share of the profit of the production of one company. Outside the Middle East, which is a different story, one way in which governments realise the profits from oil is by selling to companies the rights to explore and produce. And the companies competing for these rights include the Exxons of this world, huge companies that we know, a host of large and middle-sized companies, and increasingly state oil companies from Asia and Latin America. They're all competing for licenses to explore and produce oil. And the governments have a choice of which companies they'll let in. And this means that Western oil companies are now facing much stronger competition, and important for our discussion today, I think, have less and less leverage to dictate the terms, either financial or in terms of governance. So those of you who are familiar with the Chad experience, where an oil company and the World Bank were able to insist on rules for how oil revenues accruing to the government were managed, and we'll put aside the question of how well that's happened in effect. In my view, this just couldn't be replicated under current market conditions because governments have far more choices of who they'll go with. And it's the rapid growth of China's economy that's really driving global demand. So this increase in oil demand is leading any country with a geology that suggests that oil might be found there to invite in exploration companies. At the last count, half the countries in sub-Saharan Africa were offering oil exploration concessions, and it includes countries with ongoing or recent conflicts like Côte d'Ivoire, Liberia, Sierra Leone. So as demonstrated by the work of economists and political scientists like Paul Collier in Oxford and Michael Ross in UCLA, resource-rich countries have a huge propensity to conflict, and this is largely related to the revenues that governments get from oil. In terms of economics, dependence on natural resource revenues makes government spending programs really vulnerable to fluctuations and hence inefficiency. There's a huge temptation to spend on white elephant projects, and revenues can actually damage the rest of the economy. So oil production goes up, manufacturing or agriculture goes down. And obviously economic failures, especially failures to create employment for young men, and particularly for demobilized combatants in a post-conflict situation, is profoundly destabilizing. Politically, there's compelling evidence of the damaging effects of oil revenues on governance. One is the way in which this income coming in really insulates governments from the needs to act in ways that are acceptable to their citizens. They don't need to invest in human capital. They don't need a domestic tax base. And look at Angola, which 5 years after the war ended has still not set a date for elections. Revenues also create incentives for corruption, when, as in most developing countries, the deals under which companies extract oil and produce revenues for government aren't publicly tendered and they're not publicly disclosed. And oil revenues provide the means for pursuing violent conflict and internal repression, the cash to buy the arms. This was the case in Angola's war, especially in the 1990s when the Cold War powers were no longer providing finance, and has been and is the case in Sudan. And the other key political effect of government revenues from oil is that they break open and intensify social fissures wherever oil resources are located in the part of the country that has a distinct identity, be it ethnic, religious, or national, and give rise to secession politics. And this doesn't have to be a strong identity at the outset. So consider Scotland, where the nationalist movement was a joke, an eccentricity, before the oil and gas in the North Sea, offshore Scotland, was discovered. But yet, in the most significant constitutional change for 300 years, Scotland now has a high degree of autonomy, and there is real pressure for full independence. And that's somewhere where there's a political process to resolve these secessionist tensions. For people living in an oil-producing area, the revenues create a really powerful incentive for separation from the rest of the country. But in addition to these macro-level economic and political risks, a second route by which oil production can contribute to violent conflict is when production causes major disruptions to the environment and to the people living nearby and creates grievances. This is an issue where oil resources are onshore, for example in Sudan or Chad or northern Angola, where onshore production is starting up. Developing an oil field involves bringing in thousands of people and lots of equipment, constructing roads and housing. It takes up land, leads to an influx of outsiders, people working on the project, and migrants coming in to seek opportunities. And as well as all this bringing change that many people in the area are really going to welcome, it commonly brings an increase in crime and disorder, prostitution, local inflation, prices people are outside the oil industry, out of housing, and even out of food. It can bring in poorly controlled local security forces whose presence makes local communities less rather than more secure. And again, to take a rather more benign example, just read about the stuff in the press recently about the oil sands projects in Alberta, where you'll find startling descriptions of many of these effects taking place, absent the security issues. And I quote in the book Daniel Juergen's really interesting descriptions of Pennsylvania in the 1860s. Same thing. So it's a gold rush scenario. And I argue that the combination of failure to manage the economic and political issues associated with oil revenues and development of oil fields that creates local grievances, and if oil resources are in geographical areas with any kind of distinct identity, you've got a really big conflict risk. And the Niger Delta today shows how this can unfold into a situation where everyone loses. So how can these risks be reduced? Well, there's an emerging and credible consensus on solutions to some aspects of the curse of oil wealth. Though like most solutions, it's a lot easier to describe than to implement. So transparency in all aspects of revenue management, from the tendering of contracts to the terms of contracts to how much companies pay to what governments do with that money. And the aim of this is to reduce the space for corruption and empower citizens to demand investment in development. But it's a slow burn tool. There need to be economic measures that insulate the non-oil economy from damaging consequences. And this requires really steadying the flow of oil revenues into the economy, and particularly legal and institutional reform to try to counter the pressures to damage the rest of the economy by making it possible for manufacturing agriculture to work. These are really concerted efforts. It's a central issue to have mutually agreed rules for subnational revenue allocation. In essence, what shares do the producing areas get? That needs to be decided before production starts, rather than once everybody's starting fighting for it, because then there is no answer. And finally, limiting the conflict risks associated with oil production requires a commitment by companies and governments to avoid creating local grievances. And intense efforts are needed to avoid environmental damage and social dislocation, and to make sure that local people gain from the presence of the industry, that they have a stake in its continued operation, especially through jobs on the operation, jobs in the supply chain. Employment seems to be a much better way of creating satisfaction than philanthropic projects. There are also some conceptually very interesting arguments for doing something very much more radical, but I don't think we've got time to go into it. So, where do the companies fit in? I'm really arguing that companies ought to be contributing more to reducing the conflict risks associated directly through local impacts or indirectly through the revenues they generate for government. There's four things they need to do. They need to take responsibility for conflict prevention by minimizing the risks of exacerbating tension or conflict related to their operations. And this is really by the systematic application of high environmental, social, and human rights standards. Some companies are doing this, many aren't. I think there is a need within the industry for collaboration to develop standards, guidelines, and training, and to look for opportunities of incorporating these standards in their contracts with governments, concession partners, and contractors. I think that companies should recognize the risks of conflict presented by oil revenues, and they should really seek to exercise whatever influence they can in favor of revenue transparency, effective macroeconomic management, and agreed upon rules for revenue allocation. And there is no magic solution as to how to do that. It's going to vary company by company, country by country. Possible strategies are lobbying for concession agreements and revenue payments to become public domain information worldwide, becoming involved in EITI, participating in host country processes such as development of poverty reduction strategies. And as I discuss in the book, there have been some successes in exercising this influence, but also quite a lot of failures. Third, companies should involve other organisations with an interest in conflict prevention as stakeholders in those projects that carry a high risk of exacerbating conflict. One way to do this is to structure projects so as to require World Bank involvement. I wrote that before I joined. And that other organisation, UNDP, there are some NGOs that can be really helpful. In the book, I go into some specific things that I think companies might do in the countries, but I'm not going to go into that now. Finally, I think there is a need. All of that would make a big difference in raising the level of what all companies are doing to what some are doing now. I think there is going to be a need for companies also to start thinking about going beyond this essentially risk management approach and looking for opportunities to be catalysts for collaborators in much more fundamental partnerships between host governments, particularly in regions which have got some oil revenues coming in, with international organizations, companies, and NGOs to radically restructure the way in which oil production projects are developed so that you're having really a parallel and integrated process of local development and oil project development, so you don't just have one process chart which is on the oil side. You also have something which is about how are we going to leverage the oil industry's need for infrastructure with putting infrastructure into those regions? Can we find a way to give local communities or regions an ownership stake in the project? Can we find a way of making sure that energy doesn't only get exported, but it also goes into the area? So I think there's some really quite important changes that could be made. They'd be very challenging, but given resource nationalism that's really becoming quite pronounced in a lot of areas, quite radical changes might be needed. So, to summarise, and I've galloped through, more and more conflict-vulnerable countries are going to get into oil production. And this is going to make them more vulnerable to conflict. The key issue is government revenues and how these are managed, but the way in which oil companies manage their operations can be a positive or a negative factor too. So I think the oil companies have some limited capacity to influence revenue management. They have much more control over how they operate. And if we want to reduce these conflict risks, which are going to, as Robin said, they're going to affect us all through oil prices and growing global tensions, the international community as a whole, including business, really needs to wake up to the issue.
Good. A tour de force, a tour d'horizon. Next, I'd like to turn to Oren. There's one, you keep saying business, and I warned Oren about this yesterday. But the oil industry isn't the only business involved in oil and oil wealth. There's also something called banks. And this is where the money, and the problem, I would argue, isn't generally the oil. It's the funds from the oil. That's the problem. And the question is, what role should banks play in the international banking sector? So, on that note, I lob it over to you, Oren.
Thank you very much. I can probably speak. If anyone can't hear me, please let me know. I was quite pleased to be asked to sit on this panel to talk about a topic that is quite timely, especially as oil prices are rising. It's only exacerbating the situation. And it's more critical and crucial that countries use these resources, these ever-mounting resources, in ways which not only allow for growth and transparency, but the broad-based economic growth. I mean, I think sometimes one forgets about that. That is not just growth in a reasonable manner, but that is broad-based, as Jill has basically laid out, that all the players in these countries need to benefit from the revenues, from the resources, from the assets in their countries. And as responsible global citizens, I think companies, including banks, within the rules of law of their various countries, want to be responsible citizens and definitely have a role to play in the advocacy and support of government measures to increase transparency and rational management of the wealth. However, as I've said, with increasing oil prices, I think the challenge is going to become even greater. Oil is a global commodity, and so it is really going to be the international community. I don't think it is one particular group, even though they perhaps are the most directly engaged, that are going to have to deal with this situation. It is going to have to be a collaborative effort of the international community, banks, oil companies, citizens in the receiving countries, and at the end of the day, it is really the political will of the governments and the accountability of those governments to their citizens, as you have so rightly raised. And how does one truly consolidate that accountability from government to the citizens? Right now, well, in developed countries, that accountability is made evident and demonstrated by the relationship between elected officials, between citizens voting to support their governments, either through tax increases or not. But there are very clear and direct ways that government officials get signals from their citizens as and are held accountable. That isn't the case in most of these countries. The countries are accountable to the oil companies and to the international community. So we're trying, in some sense, to circumvent what is fundamentally the political will and governance of those countries. I mean, it's not working, so let's figure out how we can make it work better. And I think there are things like EITI that is moving forward in that direction.
Would you tell people what the EITI is?
It's the Extractive
Industries
Transparency Initiative. Thank you. That was, I believe, started by DFID. And there are a number of, and Resource Watch, exactly. And it is basically getting governments and oil companies and others in the industry to come up and agree to certain standards and processes that will be agreed to by the government in order to increase this transparency and public financial management. So EITI certainly is a step in that direction. Now speaking as a Treasury official, from Treasury's perspective, this is really only a reflection of a much greater problem, and that is the broader rational and transparent management of public resources in developing countries. It sort of is thrown into the headlight because the revenues are so large, but even in countries where those revenues aren't there, where it isn't oil, it may not be diamonds, it may not be cobalt, but in some other places, we don't look at it. You know, we're not talking really to. I'm trying to think of a country in Africa now that doesn't have exploration going on. But some country, I can't even use Benin, but a country that doesn't have on the table oil exploration. And we at Treasury are pushing really more for the broader transparent management of public revenues, and encourage through the World Bank, through the IMF, the adoption of the systematic use of the public expenditure and financial management indicators, which is another system initiative that has been put in place, which is really much broader than EITI. It's really looking to the full range of public management. However, I would just want to maybe raise a couple of questions that can be discussed. Because this is an international issue, I don't think that one can look at, say, oil companies as a monolithic group. There are many players, as has been discussed and raised a bit here. There are the super majors of the OECD, the Exxons, the Shells, etc., who have, for the most part, I would argue, have adopted standards and are willing to be those good international global citizens. However, given the evolving nature of energy demand, that there is greater and greater demand in developing countries, not just China, but also India, Thailand, Malaysia, new players are coming on the scene, some of those state-owned oil companies, for whom it is critical to identify and locate oil energy sources for those galloping growing economies. I mean, the Minister of Finance is hoping that he can slow China's economy down to 8%. So the demand is huge. And if you look at this group of oil companies, especially the majors, super majors, and the OECD companies in general, because of the awareness of their population, of their legislatures, to the issues raised in terms of conflict, they are managing their risk. This morning, Exxon announced that it was pulling out of Angola's LNG, not because the risk, the political risk, the PR risk is too great. And so you have companies that are very well aware, the Western companies that are very well aware, where they are engaged. They are doing development projects, et cetera, but in some of the more riskier oil fields to be developed, they may not be the players that are in there. They may not really be the ones who are going to be on the leading edge. It is going to be the companies coming out of Asia. And their risk profile is very different. And so I think in order to get the type of cooperation, effectiveness of these initiatives, we're going to have to bring in those new companies as well. It is really going to have to be a multilateral, even within, say, the companies, approach as opposed to a unilateral approach, And so I would just leave that sort of as a question for discussion. How does one bring in these new players whose risk profile is very different than the more established participants in the oil industry? Certainly from our, again, from Treasury's perspective, we are highly engaged in seeking to persuade governments to be more transparent. But it's difficult. It is difficult to do. We do it normally through, say, the international financial institutions in terms of the standards, et cetera. But countries are beginning to, especially with HIPC now, you know, most countries' debt has been forgiven. The hook actually isn't there. And so a number of countries either have opted out for IMF programs where we could have a bit more leverage, or are considering opting out for IMF programs. So I'd be very interested in hearing from this august body answers and discussions to some of the issues that we ourselves are facing. And I think I will leave it at that, and we can go on. I didn't touch the banks, but if we want to, in the discussion, let's touch the banks.
Okay,
we can certainly discuss that as well.
I'm not going to leave the banks alone.
I know.
Okay,
Thank
Nick?
You.
Okay, well, the question is
big oil.
Well, representing myself, but working around a lot of these issues quite a lot, and we are conveniently, my company Shell is conveniently for these purposes not a major active player in the three case studies that Jill focuses on, but as we know, these issues are very very important for us where we do operate, and just corporately as well. I mean, the question, does business have a role in peacemaking, as broadly defined by Jill? The answer is an emphatic yes. And then the interesting bit is, well, what is that role, and what are the limitations? We have a strong self-interest in this. And so if you put aside any thoughts that companies are generally trying to be good actors and responsible entities and so on, there's a very serious self-interest that I think anybody could recognise in terms of the safety of employees and families and contractors and communities in which we operate. And that, if you dismiss that, very rapidly starts to impact the long-term sustainability of projects and businesses, and that comes down to money. So if you think it's just about money, it's still very much is something that's very important. I very much endorse Jill's summary at the end that while on the revenue side, the primary responsibility is one for governments, although we definitely have a role to play there as well. And she also said that at an operational level, then the primary responsibility, again in partnership with others, rests with companies. I think that was about what you said there, and I would entirely agree with that. When it comes to a summation of the four things that companies can do, and we can go into this in the subsequent discussion, I make no claim that my company or others have all these things completely sorted out in any of the locations, in all the locations that we operate in, but I think it's pretty non-controversial to say that the responsibility again shared around conflict prevention, around one's own operations in terms of security arrangements and so on. Clearly that's right at the centre of what a company can do, again in conjunction with local governments and external players as well. But that's I think that's fairly well accepted. Not always easy, we don't always get it right, but that's one thing. The second thing you said we should do would be to be encouraging and backing moves for transparency. Totally agree with that. And much has been said about the EITI already this morning. Our company was a strong backer and continues to be a strong backer for that. It's not a perfect solve-all solution, but it's a start. It does rely, and this is one of the issues picking up from where Oren finished, this does require governments to have an incentive, which isn't always present if you haven't got a stick outside in the international community. It requires them to have an incentive to sign on, and that's some countries have done that and got cracking, and not all have. The third thing you suggested we should do was bring in other partners, whether it's World Bank or UNDP or other NGOs. And increasingly, I think you see a lot of companies realising that they can't solve all these issues themselves, even the ones that are core to their own operations, and those players are brought in as well. One thing I would say, which struck me in the book, and you mentioned it, Jill, about getting the World Bank into more projects, there is a bit of a tension there. It's not always, maybe it is a longer term solution, but of course, as many of you know, there was a lot of pressure a few years ago for Extractive Industries Review, more acronyms, yeah, Extractive Industries Review at the bank, for the bank to step back from these things. So there's a tension between the obvious potential benefits of the bank being in and inappropriate cases, and pressure to keep it out. Maybe that's where we get to other banks more broadly, defined about what role they can play if they're in instead of the World Bank. The fourth one, I think, moving from risk management to being a catalyst, is where I think not a lot of companies are universally there, and I think that's the sort of the untrodden future space by and large, and I think that's very interesting in itself. Other thoughts from a company point of view, on the one hand, because there are some interesting dilemmas drawn out in the book, because of demand and the closing off of many resource areas to companies because of global demand, these resources are going to be developed. We're not going to stop that happening, or are we? Because in fact, where conflict occurs, you do see significant problems occurring that do prevent production occurring. And I'm thinking of Nigeria at the moment. Our joint venture has the best part of 500,000 barrels per day closed in. So on the one hand, there's this enormous drive to have the resources developed, but it doesn't always play out that way. And that, I think, going back to where I started, is a strong reason for seeing why, apart from the good of society as a whole, you can see why we clearly do have an interest in figuring out what we can do to be part of the solution. There's another paradox which comes up. I think Jill rightly says that it's the time to, in the book, the time to get these things arranged and sorted is at the outset. And we all know once things are in training, it's more difficult to retrofit. And yet, paradoxically, it's precisely at that point, particularly with the advent of strong competition for limited access, more players in the market, where companies are pulled, we can like it or not, pulled between trying to get a deal done and between taking a longer term view. And I think that comes back to this catalytic role as well. It's a tension there, and we need to recognise that it's there, because as in any other sort of negotiation. There are things which are on, you know, which are important for one side or the other. Well, I think what is it that's prevented people from getting to the seeing the light, if you like, on the catalytic role? I think it comes from the fact that despite the fact that the industry inevitably, because by and large it's governments that own resources, is generally wary of stepping into politics too closely. It might surprise some of you, but I think it's true. And so there's a whole debate about what's the legitimate role of business, and I think that's moving expectations of what business should do as outlined, or can do as outlined in the book. I think show that's the case. But I would argue that, and I think this echoes what Jill's saying as well, is that the focus to date has largely been on the operational issues, which, as I say, we have been done to a greater or lesser extent, but that's where people have focused their attention. It's been less, I would argue, across the industry at the strategic sort of macro level where that catalytic role might come into play. That said, there are examples of macro approaches and that they get sort of pinned down into individual countries, and the EITI and the Voluntary Principles on Security and Human Rights are both good examples of where the industry has seen that there's a broad a broader picture. Now, of course, they, like all these things, they do end up pinning down to in a given country, in a given location. But I would argue that those are examples of a more strategic approach. So, as I say, the issue really is around the question of limitations, and that's limitations in companies' own capacity, readiness, its comfort with which areas are legitimately in its direct and indirect sphere of influence. And I think the one of the big lessons that I see in my company and in others that have come out of these things is that it really does require a variety of partnerships with different players, both in country, communities, local governments, the national governments, and outside, with host governments, sort of governments that are part of the EITI and the Voluntary Principles, and other civil society players outside the country, to find the way through this issue of we're part of the solution, but we're not the whole part of it. And so who do we need to get together with to help bring these things forward? And identifying the right linkages and acknowledging what is the legitimate role of business in certain circumstances and what is clearly the responsibility of the government receiving the revenues and the international community where it has leverage, what is the proper role there as opposed to companies, is the tricky thing that we will all be finding our various solutions to as we go down the road. And I think you picked up on that as well, that there's no sort of one single template for how some of these things are going to be resolved. It's about history and specifics and mistakes made in the past and the dynamics in particular environments. Anyway, I very much enjoyed the book, and if I can make a plug for it, if you haven't read it, it's a good read.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. To Ken Bacon, a perfect segue as a civil society advocate.
Well, thank you very much. I think I am actually supposed to be on this panel as the mouse who's supposed to roar. I don't know whether I'll fit this expectation or not.
We think of you as a lion.
From government. maybe just a small house cat. But first of all, I would like to second what Nick said. This is, I think, an extremely useful and timely book, as Oren pointed out. So I thank Jill for writing it and the USIP for supporting her during the year when she did this. And you should all read the book. It's only going to become more timely as we dig deeper and in stranger places for oil with in more misgoverned countries than we have so far. I'm going to talk about the case studies, but focus specifically on Sudan. But I have to say, after reading this book, that I was struck by the meekness of the companies and the ineffectiveness of the transparency and other initiatives at trying to deal with the types of human rights problems that arise, misgovernance problems that arise, and also basic issues of war and peace. Because I think that what the book lays out very well is the gravitation of the oil companies towards operating principles, towards transparency initiatives, towards a greater appreciation of human rights, adopting the voluntary principles, etc. Much of this done under pressure from NGOs over a long period of time, specifically Transparency International, Amnesty International, Oxfam would be three leaders in this regard. There have also been very important domestic court cases involving Unocal in Burma, and also in Sudan about human rights abuses, forcible displacement of people to build oil facilities, etc., which have had a big impact, I think, on how the companies operate. And yet, at the end of the day, what we're dealing with are governments that are extremely skillful at doing what they want. And much of what they want to do is accumulate wealth for the rulers and not spread that wealth around to the rest of the country. There's no better example of this today than Sudan. Khartoum is a boomtown. In just the 4 years I've been going to Khartoum, it's changed dramatically. The growth is, you've all read about this, there have been stories in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and the most extraordinary building is being built by China National Petroleum. This building would stand out as an architectural marvel in any city, but in Khartoum it's particularly striking because there's not a lot of architectural competition, I'd have to say, by modern standards. But we're seeing massive investment in Khartoum, where houses are now selling for over $1 million apiece in some of the fancy neighborhoods. And if you go to Darfur or South Sudan, you see no investment whatsoever. So the contrast is very striking. Sudan is interesting because it's an area where oil has fueled both conflict and peace. Clearly, oil revenues help support the government in its 21-year civil war against the South, and yet it ended up being one of the primary reasons for the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, which was worked out with a lot of American support a little over 2 years ago. The second anniversary was January 9th. And I'd just like to read you something from a press conference that John Danforth gave 6 months, 9 months after he was appointed by President Bush to be the special envoy to broker a North-South, or try to broker a North-South peace agreement. And this is what he said in April of 2002 in a report to the president. Any peace process should address the oil issue in order to resolve a major cause of conflict and to serve as the basis for a just peace. The fair allocation of oil resources could be the key to working out broader political issues. Then he goes on to say, international oil companies and foreign investors capable of making the investment needed to realize Sudan's oil potential are more likely to venture into Sudan if there is peace and political stability than in current circumstances. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. Both the government and the South realized that there could not be a full exploitation of the oil resources, which actually were sort of on the dividing line on the border between North and South, unless a peace agreement was reached. So I think that oil ended up being both a promoter of war and a facilitator of peace in Sudan. Clearly, that's what NGOs are trying to use in Darfur as well. The last time, I was in Darfur in July, there was the African Union troops in South Darfur, in a town called Gereda, were nowhere to be seen. They were performing no protective function for the people, 136,000 displaced people in Gerida. One of the days I was there, because they were off escorting a Chinese exploration team in South Darfur. So clearly there is an interest by oil companies in developing resources in Darfur. And the hope is that, and what NGOs have been concentrating on, and governments, particularly our government, is trying to get China, which is the major oil producer and purchaser from Sudan, to get China to play a greater role in trying to lean on the Sudanese government to move toward peace, on the theory that they won't be able to develop oil resources in Darfur unless there is peace. So I have to give the Bush administration credit for working on this. It's President Bush has brought it up with Hu Jintao more than once. Secretary Rice has gone to Beijing and brought it up. It's always in her talking points. And Deputy Secretary Zelik, the former Deputy Secretary, made a special trip to Beijing to talk to the Chinese about this. And Jendai Fraser, the Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, has also brought it up. But so far, it has not had an impact, unless the impact has escaped us all and affected the deeper feelings of the Chinese, but not their actions. But this remains one of the primary goals of NGOs in trying to push for peace in Sudan. Now, there are many problems with the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. Had, as Jill points out in the book, a very extensive wealth-sharing arrangement to it. And it was, in a way, there are many ways in which the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was almost a model agreement, and the wealth-sharing was one of those ways. Political power-sharing was another way. So far, the power-sharing has been slightly more effective than the wealth-sharing. There is wealth sharing going on, but unfortunately it's not as transparent as it should be, and there's a great doubt as to whether the government is, in fact, there is widespread suspicion that the government is not living up to its obligations under the wealth sharing agreement, in part because they've retained control of the energy ministry and the oil industry accounts. And they have not allowed the South to monitor these accounts. So there is a problem even under this agreement of transparency and making the agreement work. And on the second anniversary of the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, President al-Bashir of Sudan went down to Juba, which is now the capital of South Sudan, to celebrate the second year of peace, and was attacked by the president of South Sudan, Salva Kiir, for a whole litany of complaints. But one of those complaints was the not allowing enough oil revenues to the South's fair share. So this remains a problem, even though there is an agreement. Now, I began by saying that I was struck by how impotent, in a way, the reform movement that does, I believe, involve the major oil companies. I think they're sincere in trying to make these changes and trying to promote development and trying to promote human rights. They want to be good citizens in their countries. They understand that a stable country is a much better place to do business than an unstable country, and as Nick pointed out, Nigeria is a perfect example of that. On the other hand, Nigeria is one of the areas where the voluntary principles, amnesty has been very critical of what happened in 2005 when there were security problems in South Nigeria, the way both Shell and Chevron operated, maybe unfairly. Still, I think they felt that the principles would lead to more security and a better human rights record than perhaps they were that it is possible for them to do in a situation as chaotic as the one in South Nigeria. So the question is how to strengthen the hand of both the oil companies, particularly the majors who want the stability, the hands of the NGOs who clearly want it, and the hands of governments like our government, the UK, Norway, all the governments who have been working for peace in Darfur and greater stability in the region. And I think that the that this is a question that's difficult to answer, but my personal view is it's going to require much more muscular involvement by the advocates of reform, and it's unfair to think that the oil companies can do this. In the case of Sudan, the U.S. is considering, has worked out, Thorne probably doesn't want to say anything about this, so I won't put her on the spot, but Andrew Natsios, who's currently the special envoy to Sudan for the president, has been talking about a so-called Plan B, a way to increase pressure on the government of Sudan, and it involves the banking system. Frankly, it involves the fact that all oil revenues flow through, are denominated in dollars and are susceptible to pressure through U.S. banks. And this is a plan that hasn't been announced, and I don't know the details of it, but it will be very interesting to see how it works, how long it takes to work. To me, it'll be very interesting to see if it's ever invoked, frankly. The plan clearly has been discussed by the principals in the government and at cabinet levels. So it'll be very interesting to see if this works. There is a fear it could backfire. There's nothing written in Genesis that says oil revenues have to be denominated in dollars. Why not euros or yen? It could be that an effort to squeeze countries through the banking system on the theory that oil revenues are denominated in dollars could, over a period of time, backfire and actually reduce U.S. pressure. I hope it doesn't happen. But I think that there are only really three ways that we're going to reach the very hoped for results that Jill talks about in this book of trying to move toward peace, trying to move toward more equitable development and wealth sharing within a country, more equitable sharing of oil wealth within a country, and I think we would all agree toward more democratic governments in these countries. And I think that one is going to be time. This is going to take, whatever happens, is going to take a lot of time to reach better results, and we have to be patient. But we also have to be very persistent. And I think it's important for NGOs, for oil companies, and for governments, that is, outside governments such as the U.S., and international organizations, particularly the World Bank, the IMF, et cetera, where it's appropriate, to work together to apply persistent, consistent, and rational pressure on these governments over time. But I think it is going to take time. I think that that this is very much tied up with moves toward democracy, but it's precisely these huge infusions of oil revenues that protect governments like the government of Angola that's allowed them to stay in power for so long and to exert that power in a way that benefits themselves but not the country. And I haven't been to Angola since 2001. When the war was still going on, but my guess is that if I were to go back, I would see a lot of development in Luanda, the capital, but not a great amount of development in Wege, which is a regional capital in the north, or Wambo, which was the focus of terrible fighting and displacement during the long civil war. I just don't think it's a government that's interested. They went to the same school the Sudanese government went to, and they learned how to keep it, not how to spread it around, and that's what they're good at. That's going to take a long time to change. These are not failed states. They're not unstable countries. In many ways, they're far too stable, and that's part of their problem. And that's why it's so difficult, I think, for oil companies, even those who want positive change, and I accept the fact that the majors do. I don't think that the China National Petroleum Company is particularly interested in positive democratic change in Sudan or anywhere else. But particularly the majors and the human rights groups and the countries from which they come, which are democratic powers in the America and Europe, are going to make much of a difference at this stage. So in that highly optimistic way, I'll turn it back to you, Robin, to press in on the banking system.
Which is precisely what I want to do. I think the question comes up, and I want to open it to questions, but coming back to the group, I think it's clear that there are limits to what the international oil companies can do. And frankly, there are more limits now than there were 10 years ago. There are more players, A, and B, with higher prices, the companies have less leverage. I think that there are a number of different issues, but at the heart of the matter is what Ken was talking about. We're really talking about money, and we're talking about money for the leaders and for their tribe. I think that it's terribly unfair to place this. This is a huge problem. I disagree with Ken saying we must be just patient on time and everything. Frankly, we believe over time oil prices are going to go up even more, which means there's going to be more money and less incentives for people to cooperate. It's terribly unfair for the United States, for U.S. banks alone, or frankly for the 5 or 6 big international, or 10 or whatever is the number, but really sort of the OECD oil companies to bear the burden on this when there are others are playing games around it. And Oren, there's a word you used, said kind of each bank or company operating under the laws of their country. And I think that's the heart of the problem, is that when you have banks in places like Switzerland and Austria, places like this, this money's going somewhere. And it can't go to J.P. Morgan anymore. So it goes to these very large, reputable organizations which advertise about you and me and how they want to work together on television every night and every sporting event. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is they do have some responsibility. And I think transparency, rather than getting into the legal issue, is it right or wrong that the Minister of Energy get kickbacks, that's between the host government and the minister. But what's interesting is the minister is very eager that this not be disclosed. Very eager. Because whether it's the question of the law or not, it's the question of legitimacy in this country. And many of these figures would be in an absolutely unsustainable position if this came out. And what I don't understand is why there isn't greater international pressure on financial institutions just to make transparent what these people have. Why Oxfam and others don't work really very hard to put pressure on these institutions. They'll fight it. They don't like it. They're making tons of money. If you look at some of these banks and the amount of money they're making in private banking, what do you think private banking is? In some cases, it's just rich people's managing rich people's portfolio, but it's managing some very rich people's portfolios very discreetly, which is what they want. So I think this, as I say, I think this is when I began, this is a huge problem. And that transparency is the key, and that nice multilateral initiatives that are sort of hortatory, to urge people, aren't going to get very far. And I think, as I say, financial institutions, frankly, have much more power in this than the oil companies. So after that, Nick or anyone, do you want to comment on this? Or Oren, do you want to comment? What do you think?
I can throw out a couple of thoughts. I agree with you that, in the case of the United States, that the oil industry, that the revenue flows are certainly a key, a critical element of it. And certainly in the U.S. government, we have taken steps to address that within the context of the United States. I think it is perhaps the role of the NGOs and some other organizations to work with other governments to change their banking laws. I mean, we cannot impose it upon other countries. But certainly if there is, and that's where I sort of get back again to the need for consensus within the international community. Right now there really isn't. I mean, there are these different players out there who, for a variety of reasons, are somewhere along the spectrum. Okay. And so to the extent, especially in the OECD, to the extent that the citizenry, the companies, the NGOs can have an impact on the financial industries that may be supporting these activities, we would certainly be supportive of that. But we cannot take a unilateral or a extraterritorial approach. One, legally, even though you said we're not talking about the legal issues, but legally, what, you know, there are many discussions about what could we actually do, extraterritoriality, and the case, the experience has shown that we really have not been very successful doing that. So it really has to be the constituencies within Switzerland that are raising the question of the role of their banks in this sector. And I will sort of leave it at that for the time being.
Does anybody want to comment on this?
Well, I mean, I agree with you. It's a new frontier, and it's one that that all of us in the NGO community should press on. I do think that NGOs have been NGOs like Oxfam, which has paid a lot of attention to trade and a lot of attention to resources. Resource Watch came up earlier. Transparency International have done a good job, but there's much more to do. And what I didn't mean to say this should take a lot of time, but my prediction is it will take a lot of time. And if you look at how long Oxfam and Transparency have been working on a number of these initiatives, it's been 10, 15 years. So this is what I think we're looking at, cracking the international banking system and turning them into policemen against dictators and how they use their money is not something that's going to happen overnight.
Let me ask, and I'll turn over the floor, but... let me ask a question. Are there any real success stories in this area? I mean, Chad was a success story on paper that turned out to be a disappointment. Go ahead.
And this is, you know, again, this is my sort of from personal observation. It seems to be that where there have been success stories in terms of extractive revenues have been in countries, and maybe I'll even qualify with the case of Scotland, but have been in countries where the social contract and the institutional arrangements of that country were well in place before the revenues came up. The need for sort of the social contract, the understanding of how our government works, I'm not talking about my government, but for that citizen, that there is a buy-in and a consensus on the role of government, on the role of citizens, on the priorities of the society in terms of education or health or whatever. It seems to me that where there have been successes, and I would even discount the Middle East in this case, has been in a relatively limited number of countries. Unfortunately, oil revenues have not proven themselves to be resources that help in institution building. And you sort of need the institutions before the revenue goes in place, or otherwise it just sort of perverts the institution construction. You talked about the case of Chad with the college that would oversee the use of the resources and the fund for future generations. And in fact, we were very supportive. Treasury had technical advisors in Chad working on this, as well as the World Bank. Unfortunately, and this is indeed the challenge, especially with increasing prices of oil, once it was online and the revenues started coming in, the contract was changed. I mean, fundamentally, it was changed. And so even though one had gone through that process of laying out the need to stabilize flows so as to avoid Dutch disease, the need to direct it in a more transparent manner and have civil society and society engaged in in this process. Having a international financial institution sort of involved as well, sort of as a insurance policy, if you will, for the oil companies. Once the flows are in, it was changed, the contract was changed because, and I would guesstimate that, as, you know, if I were dead, you've already stuck your investment in. You're not going to pull it out. You can't pull it out. The competition is continually growing, so if you do pull, there are others who are more than ready to come in. And so if you want to continue producing, we're going to have to change the contract. And that is, in fact, what happened. So, and that was, you know, last year. If, in fact, oil prices continue to grow, I think that one might see that type of leverage. I think the leaders, however insular and isolated they are quite aware of the environment in which they're the evolving environment in which they're operating, and the fact
their
that
bankers
they
will advise them that.
Well, and their bankers may advise them, but they themselves have their own agendas in terms of the political realities within their countries, and I think they recognize that they indeed have a certain leverage over the rest of the world. You know, and that I don't see that changing in the near term. Unfortunately, I think it is sort of an evolutionary type thing. If in fact, if you look at, say, in Africa, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but I did see a statistic recently that last year, the U.S., Africa actually eked out the Middle East in terms of the total volume of oil. I mean, it was very, very close. But I did see an article saying that actually oil imports from Africa actually eat.
That's to the United States.
Yeah. No, that's what I'm saying, to the United States. But yes, to the United States, I should have said that. But what it says is that these environments that are the most unstable, we're becoming more reliant upon, and they recognize that. And so I think there is a need to, again, on a global scale and as a community, international community, come up to certain minimum standards. And that's also talking about the Chinese oil companies that are you going to, you know, or the Indian. I'm not going to just pick on the Chinese. India is also very big in Sudan. Malaysia is also in Sudan. So it's really trying to get some of the others to agree so that there is more leverage that can be then brought to bear.
Jill, one other area that is where production is surging that's kind of a boomtown, kind of like Africa, is the Caspian, is Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan. Are things better, worse, different there? Is there anything to draw confidence there, or are they basically suffering the same?
I think the difference, certainly in Azerbaijan, I think the picture is a little bit better, but it's a little bit better because the government of Azerbaijan, certainly a few years ago when all the key decisions were being made, had a really strong geopolitical interest in aligning itself with the West. So essentially, that it was for the oil companies, the NGOs, the international institutions pushing at the Azerbaijan government to do more in terms of revenue transparency, to accept the large amount of work and the long time taken to deal with the environmental and social aspects of the project. It was pushing at an open door because they really wanted to align with the West and get some degree of separation from Russia. So I think that's a significant thing in Azerbaijan, to some extent in Kazakhstan, but I think the global politics are changing now. Whereas in Angola and Sudan, the interests of the governments have been to pull themselves away from the West, so they're very, very open to the alternative investors, and they're very resistant to pressure. But I think there are a lot of people here who probably
I'd like to turn it over to the floor. Are there any questions from the floor?
Let me just ask if folks could please identify themselves and their institutions. We'd invite you to come to one of the mics on either side of the room, and you could just line up, and we'll open it up.
Judy Barthel, U.S. Institute of Peace. I just have a quick question as to whether or not there are any lessons to be learned, focusing on Robin's injunction that we should be focusing on the banking industry. Are there lessons to be learned in the way that both the United States and the international community have handled the sort of imperative to track flows of funds supporting terrorist groups in a post-September 11th world, and not only track those flows, but also sanction the institutions that handle the money. Are there any lessons to be learned for this topic?
Are we going to do it one by one, or are we...
Anybody want to comment on that?
I would say there certainly are lessons to be learned in terms of perhaps the mechanics and what could be brought to bear. And we are, in the U.S. government, exploring those.
Okay. We're going to have a... I've been advised here by the powers that be that we're going to do is have a series of questions and then have the board and have the group then respond. So, sir...
Good morning. I'm Hussein Ibn Yusuf, International Petroleum Enterprises. I really agreed with most of what you guys talked about today. Particularly enjoyed the suggestions that Orrin had on some kind of setting up some kind of a standard, and I suggest that this standard should be fairness. A number of things was discussed. Jill gave a list of what oil companies should do, and Nick, of course, defended the oil companies and talked about what has been done so far and so on. But I really did not hear anything about the grievances that producing countries have had, the unfair practices of the past, the taxes in particular that would give producing countries a considerable amount of additional income than the producing countries. And also the fact that most of that money that these countries are producing gets recycled. Only a few industrialized countries, basically get that money, and unfortunately most of it for selling arms and things of that nature. So there is enough blame to go around, and I think, and it would probably be much easier because there'll be fewer countries, major consuming countries, with those kinds of capabilities to control those, rather than over 100 producing countries. Just a suggestion, and I was wondering, how you could comment on those. Thank you.
Let me go to this side. We'll go back and forth here.
I'm Ann DeVera with Partners for Democratic Change. And I have a slightly different topic I want to ask a question about. I just came back from Indonesia. And even though there are many problems in Indonesia, there's widespread recognition that Indonesia is no longer an emerging democracy. That really one that has a credible and strong foundation. It's had 2 years into an administration of a popularly elected president. It successfully managed scores of local government elections and installed new popularly elected governors, district heads, and local legislatures. It successfully brought to an end a decade of armed conflict and turbulence in Aceh, which recently installed its first popularly elected governor, which was a former leader of the armed separatist movement. Second, within this increasingly, I think, confident democratic framework, civil society is robust and active in virtually all regions at all levels. As Indonesia's decentralization program has dramatically shifted political authority to the district level, there's been a correspondingly dramatic increase in the number of NGOs and community group and civil associations, really at all levels. So my question is this really has posed in Indonesia new challenges for the oil and gas and mining industries? Companies that really are used to dealing with the central government now are looking at dealing with local governments. And this is new territory for them. And one company that I talked to was looking at, rather than dealing with the central government, and now dealing with 7 districts because their operations span 7 districts. So what would you suggest around dealing, how to deal for the extractive companies, how to deal with this issue, what programs to put in place, et cetera? Just generally, what do you think about how companies should be dealing with this?
Okay, thank you. Well, we'll get back to all these.
My name is Deirdre LePin. I'm a consultant for USIP and also for the IFC in my IFC hat. I'd just like to remind the panel about the Equator Principles and the IFC's new performance standards, which were to some extent the culmination of that process. We now have 40 banks or more that subscribe to the Equator Principles.
That is in project finance, isn't it?
It is in project finance, but it does show that there can be a confluence of energy and effort around an ethical issue in banks. So that may be the starting point for the trend that you would like to see. In any event, in my USIP hat, though, I'm thinking my question is sort of focused on that big question, how to spend it. You know, anyone who reads the Financial Times on the weekend occasionally sees this glossy magazine called How to Spend It, and you look inside, and there are all these Rolexes and trips to Mauritius and so on that it looks as though anybody who has unlimited funds could buy and on the spur of the moment make the decision. This is somewhat reminiscent of the resource, the oil resource curse that a lot of countries face. And actually, I did a calculation after Jill's comment about the $2 million an hour. Actually, Nigeria's government makes about $5 million total an hour on the oil industry, if this is correct. So it's a huge amount of money. Now, at the same time, why aren't things better? Doing the project for the USIP, I finally came to the conclusion that there is such a thing as the electoral democracy curse. We've been exporting electoral democracy, and as Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala last week mentioned at SAIS in a speech, we've created a monster with this thing. At the end of the 1990s, when Nigeria was moving to a democratic government, I'm going to use that example, the famous negative example of Nigeria, the oil majors were doing all the things that Jill said. They were starting in this process of, sustainability guidelines and responsibility. They were exercising influence on revenue. They set up the Niger Delta Development Commission. They were involving partners from all of the sectors in huge stakeholder meetings. And they were also acting as catalysts. They introduced community-based development in a region, the Niger Delta, that didn't have it before. But what happened was that the traditional constituencies in the Niger Delta, that is the families and the tribes, became more important than the responsibility to the electorate. And those who were elected began to take these revenues and figure out how to spend it. And the way to spend it was responding to pressure of their constituencies. What process can be put in place that involves actors from government, civil society, and the private sector to stem the tide of this trend, which is only beginning, I'm afraid, in many countries?
Thank you.
My name is Paul Wee, U.S. Institute of Peace. Somewhat the same question, so I won't prolong it. You mentioned, Jill, that in the Niger Delta, everybody is losing. That's clear if you spend a couple days down south of Port Harcourt in what they call the creeks. You see firsthand what many people are losing. You see the total environmental devastation in many parts of what they call Ogoniland. You take the boat past the oil companies, you see the intense poverty among the villages, villages that have no electricity, that are living right above the land where the oil, from which the oil is extracted. So you see the tremendous frustration. There is talking to the militia groups, you find that this frustration has come out now in tremendous amounts of violence. It could be a place where everybody wins, where the people win, the local government wins, the oil companies win. There's no question about that. And my question is simply, the little visit that I took a couple months ago was mainly by people who directed their aggressions against Shell, oil spills, environmental damage, no hospitals, no infrastructure. There was one hospital in the area that I went, very poor, very. But I know it's not that simple. And you can't single out Shell and get your aggressions out. But my question comes back to the fact that we do, as the last speaker asked, we do need a model that would allow everybody to win. I mean, you can go to the big casinos of France and you see the 1,000-franc chips that are put down by some of the godfathers from Nigeria, you know, who have reaped this tremendous benefit and have not shared it for the development of the community. And you see these two extremes, and you can't justify the militia activity, but you can certainly understand it. And so it's incumbent upon us, it seems, to put together a type of a model in which these people will start to talk to each other. What are the elements of that model, if you took the Niger Delta as an example? Thank you.
Aroma Vetisyan, George Mason University. My question is also related to the model and international control mechanism, how it's possible to prevent conflict, further conflict, and how it's possible to reduce tension. But my question is certainly related to the Caspian region, especially Azerbaijan, relationship between Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Nagorno-Karabakh. As we facing and witnessing now, there is a really increase of nationalism in Azerbaijan, a lot of military aggression and aggressive behavior towards its neighbors. That's what we are, and it's coming along with the oil revenues which Azerbaijan started receiving from Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan project. So my question is, what certain mechanism exists or it's possible to enforce to prevent further new conflict in this region, which caused disaster for all countries of South Caucasus? And at the same time, how it's possible to make Azerbaijan direct its revenues not on the army, not on the developing of its military sector, but developing on more peaceful. Thank you.
Great. Good morning. I'm Lori Regelbrugge with PACT, and thank you for the great presentations. My question is, in Cambodia, where the resources have not yet been developed, we are not certain there's commercial viability there, but yet there are resources that have been identified. How do we engage the needed constellation of players and lessons learned from every example people have given to get it right in Cambodia, which does not have the institutional infrastructure or capacity yet to really make the work of transparency and anti-corruption real, and yet where we've got a chance to chart new ground in really promoting and achieving a better development approach? So how do we do it? Thanks.
Hi, I'm Karina Gilfillan with Global Witness. We have a Washington, D.C. office. I wanted to comment about wanted to focus on the issue of oil revenue management. Jill and others mentioned initiatives like the EITI that are working to make revenues from oil extraction transparent and importantly to make sure that that information gets to citizens, so that citizens can hold their government accountable. But I think that there's, you know, these initiatives are voluntary, and I think obviously there are huge challenges with actually implementing them. There's some serious challenges that we're now facing with the EITI. on a organizational level, a Global Witness recently had one of its campaigners, senior campaigners, Sarah Wykes, that was arrested in Angola, and we're still fighting to get her out of the country. She was there in an open way, meeting with governments, meeting with government bodies and civil society groups on progress made on transparency, and has been arrested on baseless charges. She's been given no documentation on those charges. We're still trying to get her out of the country. This has not just happened to employees of Global Witness. This is happening in Congo Brazzaville, where activists, anti-corruption activists, were arrested last year in the Democratic Republic of Congo. So it's a very worrying trend. And what's also very, very disturbing is that Angola and Congo Brazzaville are actually on the ITI website. So how do we make these agreements actually mean something in practice? And it's very dangerous if countries can sign up to EITI and get credit for it when at the same time they're going after campaigners that are trying to bring more open management of these revenues. So it's a very worrying trend, and so I wondered what panelists felt about this trend and the fact that this is a multi-stakeholder engagement, some of which a lot of questions have been raising about getting these multi-stakeholder engagements going, but we have EITI, that's multi-stakeholder engagement, and this is the problem we're facing. What is the role of companies? What is the role of the U.S. government, the host governments? How do we deal with those kinds of really serious issues? And just one other brief thing. We recently did launch a campaign looking at the financial sector and their role in corruption, particularly in natural resource and corruption issues. So I just wanted to let you know that we launched that late last year, and hopefully my colleagues who are experts on that will be coming to the U.S., to D.C., to do some work on that. We're coming up with some concrete policy recommendations and looking at whether banks should be part of EITI, looking at how to address that issue. So while we think oil companies have to play a very important role, we also are looking at other actors in this as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ian Gary from Oxfam America, and I wanted to ask Jill a question, which is probably an unfair question because I know how hard it is to write a book and then get it published 2 years later because issues are always moving. But the question of a model has come up various times, and also I wanted to ask forgiveness because I was late, and I don't know if you discussed this in any detail, but the question of the Chad Cameroon Project. And your book makes a statement that it's clear that you can design projects now that actually benefit people nearby the project zone, and that the Chad Cameroon Project is an example of this. When I co-authored a report and released it in 2005, we had the charitable assessment that the jury was still out on the Chad Cameroon Project. I would argue now that the jury has come back with the verdict, and unfortunately it's in line with the resource curse experience in many other countries around the world. In the project zone, the population has really not experienced any real benefit, and it's hard to argue that their situation has improved. In fact, in a meeting with the World Bank recently, we asked them if they could state that the situation has improved for people living in the Doba project zone, and they will refuse to do that. There's been increased drilling, infilling, so more well pad areas have been taken up. There's been corruption, government officials taking money from compensation payments. There's more insecurity in the project zone. So I'm wondering if you have a slightly different assessment now than when the manuscript went to press on the Chad Cameroon Project. Thanks.
Hi, I'll try to be brief. My name is Breon Dawson. I'm with the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs, and we are embarking on publishing a report that will look at 10 case studies and discuss the role of governments in managing revenues from extractive industries, particularly the role of the legislatures. And it seems, I really appreciated the suggestion from Oren that we need to, that where there are success stories, those have come from where there are social contracts and institutions in place in advance of the introduction of oil revenues. And I wanted to just ask, it seems that there are differences of opinion among the panelists about institutions and strengthening institutions like legislatures, other accountability agencies. We know that in many countries where Governance has failed. There is also a lack of investment in equitable distribution of wealth resulting from extractive industries. And I'd just like to hear from the reactions from the panelists about getting the institutional mechanisms right, putting more resources into accountability mechanisms. What is the role of the international community in supporting that level of reform, and to what extent can that make an impact on effective management of resources from extractive industries? Thanks.
Sure.
I'd like to just add one last question, which may seem to be a rather naive question, but a number of people have talked about the non-Western companies waiting in the wings to come in and take over the investments that Western companies might abandon. And I'd like to just pose the question, wouldn't the same kinds of considerations that cause Western companies to abandon conflict zones or not to invest in conflict zones also apply to some extent to other non-Western companies?
Okay. We have lots of... I don't know whether we just want to... let me begin with Jill, how she wants to deal with this basket of queries. And then everyone else, please jump in after Jill.
Okay. There's a whole lot of really interesting points, mostly about how on earth do we try to make progress on these issues. What about grievances of producing countries? Yeah, clearly there are grievances of producing countries, and I think particularly in what I've looked at, the whole political grievances that Angola in particular has about the way the rest of the world has intervened in an appalling way in Angola, from slavery to colonialism to being a proxy Cold War, has left a residue where people are very, very reluctant to take seriously any sort of suggestions coming from the West, and that's a really serious problem. And I'm going to skim through this incredibly quickly.
That's also a convenient response.
It's a convenient, it is a true and a convenient response, which is why it's so difficult. Indonesia, yeah. It might turn out to be a success story, which would be great. Working at the district level, I think for the oil company, there's still the two things they've got to do. They've got to really make sure their operations are clean. They've got to really focus on providing jobs locally, having a local supply chain. We all know in Indonesia there's a big struggle with how to deal with the military. And they're going to need to work with those districts that are now getting revenues coming in to try to work with them to use those revenues. They're not going to come in forever. They're going to come in for a defined period, and to really get some understanding of how to use those revenues in a beneficial way. But I think there are more possibilities of operating successfully locally than there are when things are controlled at a national level. The kind of curse of electoral democracy, I think we all know from the events of the last few years that seeing democracy as being elections and elections only is an absolute disaster. And Oren and everybody else has talked about institutions. I don't know the solution, but yeah, just providing a mechanism by which elites compete to control resources, and that is described as democracy, is clearly, absolutely not going to get anyone anywhere. Nick's going to defend Shell.
Am I?
Are you? I have no idea what the solution there is. I think the foundations were laid a very long time ago. In my view, I think the oil companies really made some very bad mistakes in the 70s and are having to live with that despite huge efforts to try to improve things later. Cambodia, it's the same prescription. It's trying to bring everybody on board to try to get rational revenue management and serious control of local impacts, and to try to systematically identify what leverage is there in those early days before the money starts flowing. And then we go to Ian's point. I think Chad Cameroon has still done a better job at risk avoidance than a whole lot of other projects I've worked on, or that I know of. But it's really the limitations locally, as well as the very well-recognized huge problems about the revenue management, that have led me to say, actually, we need to be looking at a completely different model for developing these oil projects, where you really are trying to run development and oil production in tandem. But then we flick back to your Cambodia problem. How do we create the political will to do things differently? And I think it's only going to happen in either very, very small countries developing oil, or where there's already a high level of regional control over what happens. I can't even read my writing anymore. I'm going to shut up.
Nigeria. I don't think I'm going to take issue with the fact that mistakes have been made in the past, efforts have been made. It's much more difficult to put things right later. But I think from the efforts that in the time I've been involved with that subject, it's so clear to me that it's part of a much bigger issue, and it's one of the issues which you're addressing in here about the society-wide use of revenues and so on. I mean, mistakes by companies don't govern the whole space there, so it's definitely problematic. The issue of sort of grievances over taxes and so on, well, one of the good things about transparency is, if you're paying what anybody would normally think is fair, is that you can get that out and see it. And one of the things we did in Nigeria particularly was to, before the EITI, was publish the taxes. And when you look at the percentages, people, it's a question of communication down to the roots. People suddenly start to understand the amounts of money involved and the amounts of taxes and where they are going. So that doesn't solve it all, but I think if you've got a fair arrangement and you publicise it, then people start to understand who they need to hold accountable. Complex arrangements in Indonesia and maybe the Cambodia thing. The biggest thing companies need to do is to devote enough resource at an early enough time to get their heads around all of that. And the challenge there is, because that can be a very, very intensive and complex process, particularly if it's a new country that you haven't had much exposure to for a while, or a new dynamic. And the problem with that is that sometimes when they're not major, it's okay for people that are already operating there to extend. If you don't have a big investment going in, getting the human resources to deal with the above ground things is a battle internally, because you get, you can have 5% of what we're investing to spend on this. You may really need 30% to make it work. So that is a problem. Institutions, there's undoubtedly the case, I mean, there's a lot of talk around corruption. Some of the stuff is capacity. I mean, it's quite clear when you deal with people grappling with these things, it's true in a lot of countries, that there's just not the capacity. That's certainly something that can be done with the assistance of companies, but with people like the World Bank and the IMF and so on. Non-Western companies, are they exposed to some extent to the same issues? They certainly are. I suppose the one that people would typically say they're not exposed to is the reputation risk back here. I think that is a very good case for ensuring that we have an open trading system all over the place, so that people can invest and start to get exposed to the types of, invest in the United States or Europe, you start to get exposed to those sorts of pressures that we do. But the other pressures on the ground, then they're definitely exposed to those issues, kidnappings and all those other bits and pieces.
I'll just take I saw a couple of things that gel that I'd like to maybe to address, and one having to do with the Chad Cameroon pipeline and the project and the effort, because there was an enormous amount of effort made to try to pull that together into something that was feasible. I think that tied in, there was a desire to assure that there would be sort of an objective, this collège that would assist. I think from my perspective, what didn't happen was trying to tie that with institution building. The college was sort of set out there separately. Its budget was relied upon the government, which I thought was an enormous mistake. because how objective can you be when the resources to do your activity was coming from the very government that you were there to sort of oversee? It would have seemed to me at the time that if we were looking at institution building, to have the college really as part of a legislature, because it was indeed representing civil society and those various groups, there is a recognition of the lack of capacity in legislatures, and so to have associated the college with the legislature, sort of like a what, congressional
research service.
Yeah, I mean, so, and have them related to that so that they could feed in to the representatives and really put more pressure on those elected representatives to respond to what was going on. It seemed to me would have been a better structure. Overall, I don't think there is a model. That's the problem. There is no model. And if one even comes up with, I think this was a pretty good one. I think it probably would need to be tweaked in a particular situation. But I think what occurred, the environment in which that model was set up, has evolved. And so the dynamics are very different now. And one might need, one would almost have to look at different models for different countries. Again, part of the model rely upon the amount of institutional development. Part will rely upon capacity in the country. And quite honestly, part will rely upon the political will and accountability of the government. I mean, we can go through lots of, you know, EITI, Angola's on the list, and yet someone is being arrested who has a legitimate reason to be there and presumably doing something that Angola has signed up for. I think there are these inconsistencies or contradictions that will continue to play as long as the price of oil is high. The developing country leaders know how to work the system. And so if in fact to get legitimacy, I must consider signing up for EITI, I'll consider it. Implementation, not as consistent, but at least I'm on the list, and that gives sort of cover for then other investors to come in, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think, unfortunately, I don't think there is a single model, but I do think that getting international community agreement, or not agreement, but certainly consensus around some broad themes, and bringing in some of the non-OECDs, because as long as you have the National Chinese Petroleum Company, who will go into Sudan, it's going to be very difficult to have any leverage over the Sudanese government. Extremely difficult. And so I think there is more effort that's going to need to be put pressure on those. And we are, as you indicated, you know, we talk with the Chinese all the time, and certainly that is one of the issues in terms of their role in Africa and other developing countries and transparency and governance issues. I think that still has to go on. I think other, even OECD countries, constituencies are going to have to perhaps meet the level of the standards that we have done in the U.S. I mean, you know, in some extent, when I read in the paper that a pension fund for a university has voted to withdraw their investments from the United from companies that are working in Sudan, that's a great statement. Unless we have a consensus, there really is no penalty. It's a public statement, but it's not having the impact on Sudan. And so until we can get that broader consensus for action, I think it's going to be hit and miss.
Okay. The advantage of being the last speaker is you really don't have to say too much. So I'm just going to say one thing. I felt that one of the more intriguing recommendations in the book was that oil companies should get more involved in building civil society movements within the countries where they operate. And I think, going to Paul's question, what's the model for win-win, I think that's somewhere for where the model is. Because in the early stages of these negotiations, few governments say, we're going to allow Shell into our country so we can all get rich. and screw everybody else. At some level, they all want to say, this is going to be great for Nigeria, this is going to be great for X. And that's the time where it seems to me that international financial institutions, the oil companies, and a wide range of actors have an opportunity to be imaginative and to tie what they're doing to the Millennium Development Goals, to tie what they're doing to education plans, and maybe even to divert some of the revenues, perhaps some from the oil companies and some from the government, into very visible projects in the areas where the work's being done, which will not only build public support for what they're doing, but over the long term, particularly with education, could help build a civil society movement. Now, I realize it's much easier to say this on 17th Street in this wonderful building than it is to do it in Abuja, Nigeria, but it still opens opportunities, and I think this is what we all should be thinking about doing, ways to sort of create win-wins at the very earliest stages.
Okay. We're right on time. Thank you all for a long program.